Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I look down on people who invest a lot of time and energy into status symbols that can just go away in a second.
This is Opportunity Costs from Death, Sex, and Money.
I realize that I'm never going to be a gazillionaire.
A series all about class, which we think about a lot.
They came straight off the pages of a J. Crew catalog.
And need to talk about more.
So it has caused some friction in our relationship.
I'm Anna Sale. The first time Ernie Major wrote us an email was a few years ago when we did an episode about living alone.
I live in a single-wide trailer in Vallejo, California.
He emailed us again when we asked for stories about class. I don't feel inferior to other people of higher class, he wrote. In fact, sometimes I feel kind of sorry for them, trapped in their web of expectations. I decided to go visit Ernie in Vallejo. It's about a 30-minute drive from where I live now. His trailer park is just off the highway. He told me to look for the lot with a couple of motorcycles parked outside.
Hi, Ernie.
Ernie's dog, Mindy, greeted me as soon as I got out of the car.
Come on, dog. Come on.
We headed into his trailer, and Ernie showed me around inside.
A very brief tour of the high points.
Yeah.
If you step in there and look to your right, you will see the latest addition.
The washer-dryer?
The washer-dryer.
Oh, how long have you had that?
Oh, a couple months.
It's life-changing, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
My mother-in-law said that a washer and a dryer are what separates middle-class people from poor people.
Oh.
I've obviously moved up.
He's obviously moved up, he told me.
Go lay down.
Ernie is 73 and on long-term disability after a motorcycle accident a year ago. He settled into his recliner. Mindy settled into her bed right by him. And he told me about crossing back and forth across class lines many times in his life. Until recently, Ernie worked at an oil refinery in a control room monitoring safety cages. That was his second career. First, he was a photographer at local papers. He worked in newsrooms for two decades, but he never felt like he fit in.
There's a couple really great people that I still have contact with, but for the most part, it just didn't stick socially.
How do you feel in relation to the term middle class?
I think I'm socially lower middle class, economically a bit better than that, or at least I was. Now I'm retired.
What's so, socially lower middle class mean?
Means the people I hang with. I usually have breakfast at Maggie's, this little joint here in town, and all my friends are bikers and things like that. So, yeah, I don't aspire to move up.
Has that always been the case?
Pretty much, yeah.
Why do you think that is?
That's where I'm most comfortable. Yeah.
Does it feel? What have you noticed about how you feel class-wise now that you're not working?
Well, I still live in this pretty gritty part of town. You know, I've had a burglar being chased through the trailer park run up on me while I was outside working on a motorcycle one time. And I pulled a pistol out of my pocket and said, "Bad idea." And he turned around, went the other way, and I heard him chasing him down the street. But, you know, it's, I kind of like it here.
Growing up, Ernie wrote us, we were often dirt poor. His family moved across the West in the 40s and 50s, following work.
We were fruit tramp. We called it fruit tramping. You know, we lived in a one-room place on a homestead in Arizona. And before that, one in Wyoming that went bankrupt. But my dad was always very working class. Heavy equipment operator, worked in a gas station.
You said in your email to us when you were writing about class, you said, the thing about my parents is they never felt inferior to anybody.
Oh, no. Yeah. My mom made a point of it. I remember we had in Arizona, we had a Model A that didn't have a top. The top had been cut off. And sometimes when we didn't have enough gas, my dad would make a mixture about 50% gas and 50% kerosene. And when we drove the thing, it smoked. And I remember us coming to church, all dressed in our Sunday best. And my mom would never flinch. There were people there that are way better off than we were, but we'd go in and, thought nothing, acted like she thought nothing of it. And so we didn't either. So, yeah.
Do you think of that as confidence, as pride? Like, what do you think that was?
Pride. Mm-hmm. Yeah. She always told us, even though we obviously didn't have the kind of money or education or anything of her family, is that we were exceptional. We were living a pretty good life, an interesting life anyhow. And that was the point.
Ernie's mom and dad met when they were both serving in World War II in North Africa. His mother's parents had been wealthy before the Depression, and some of her relatives still were. At family gatherings as a boy, Ernie saw their swimming pools and their tennis courts. But his father's family didn't have much, and they didn't think much of those who did.
Class cuts both ways. And when my father returned from the Second World War, bringing his, as they saw it, fancy woman from the West Coast, from Berkeley, who couldn't cook, couldn't sew, had no useful skills. They were cooking on a wood stove. You know, they had no electricity. They, you used a lantern after dark.
So you're saying your dad's family, when your dad brought your mom back, who was from this fancy family,
yeah,
they sort of thought of her as a little bit useless.
Oh, a lot useless.
She didn't know how to do anything.
In the summer, we would travel, and we would follow the harvest, the later part of the summer.
Mm-hmm.
But there were jobs that white people could get just by being white people. My dad could usually get a job in the packing shed driving a forklift or something. Usually didn't have to go out and do the picking as kids did. It was illegal, but we did.
How old were you?
We were in grade school still.
Uh-huh.
And
were you working alongside adults?
Oh, yes.
Were the adults mostly not white?
Mostly, but there was a certain amount of I'd call them old alcoholic guys that worked in there too. This was the 50s. There were still, quote, Okies, and but they were being pushed out by the Mexican part.
Do you think, kind of thinking back to your time as a kid working in the fields, like, do you think that ability to kind of not feel emotionally invested in where you were fitting in the hierarchy is related to being able to kind of move between because you're white?
White, and I had my mom's family was upper middle class for sure, So I had a connection with people who were not, definitely not the same as us.
Coming up, Ernie talks more about how he thinks being white has shaped the way he sees class.
Well, I understood early on that it gave you a step up, even though we were dirt poor.
As we've been making this series, one thing we've heard over and over again is how your class status can bring up a lot of feelings of pride and of shame, sometimes both at the same time. A listener named Elizabeth even said that's how she defines class.
So since I was a kid, I've always had this idea about class. To me, class is a sense of pride or shame. I had this realization when I was 11 and my family moved at one part of town that wasn't the best. And we did move into a medium-sized home. Most of my classmates lived in a trailer park. So because of, I guess, this difference, I was teased. I kind of felt ashamed.
We made a survey asking you to tell us what about your class status makes you feel proud and what makes you feel embarrassed. We've gotten a lot of great answers already. Robert in Phoenix is proud because
I didn't go to college and barely graduated high school. I was just fortunate enough to find something I'm good at that pays well.
But he feels shame that
often I feel like a fraud.
Wendy in Florida says she's proud of her
stable, loving marriage. My car is paid for and I own a home in a gated community. But I'm ashamed that I feel like teenage me would consider me a sellout.
And Tisha in Rhode Island says,
I'm trying the best I can, but I'm always broke.
Those are some of our coworkers at WNYC giving voice to your messages. You can add your feelings of pride and shame at deafsexmoney.org/class, our website for this series. Just scroll down and click Take Our Survey. You can also tell us a song that represents your class identity. We're putting together a Spotify playlist from your suggestions. Take a look at what's already been added. There's a link on our Facebook page. These five episodes are it for our Opportunity Cost series for now. But given that money is in our name, we'll keep taking bites out of this big apple. Thanks to the hundreds of you who have shared your class stories so far. You can find all five episodes from this week at deathsexmoney.org/class, as well as a link to all the essays and reported pieces BuzzFeed News has published in this collaboration. And you can email us anytime with stories about class or anything else at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. Ernie Major was the first person in his immediate family to go to college. He served in the Air Force in Vietnam and went to school on the GI Bill.
Rode that pony till it wouldn't get up anymore.
Ernie got degrees in economics and political science from Sonoma State, and he became friends with people in the civil rights and Black Power movements in the Bay Area. That sometimes put him at odds with his family.
I would hear my dad and some of the local hangers-on talking about keeping the Black people out. And they felt threatened by him. And I go, Dad, you like every one of them you know. And he go, yeah, they're the exceptions. Yeah. So one of my brothers who worked in construction his whole life, he was in his late 50s hanging sheetrock, and that's a hell of a job. And that's why he's hurting so bad nowadays. He had, you know, got to watch him. He has kind of a thing about Mexicans. He felt economically threatened by them. And he doesn't remember the fruit tramping days and stuff so much. You know, he's 7 years younger than I am. And he was a very young kid during all that. So there's that kind of edge to being in the actual working class that I managed to kind of be the one who got a little above.
So does that ever feel, when you say you feel like socially lower middle class, when things like race come up among other white people, do you ever feel like, and someone says something that's anti-Mexican or something that sounds racist to your ears?
I say something. Uh-huh. I don't hide. I mustered out of the Air Force in Savannah, Georgia, worked in a bike shop for almost 3 years there. People start talking about you know, nigger-loving Yankees, and I'd raise my hand and go, what, here, you know?
It was right after college that Ernie got started in photojournalism. But as he got older, he worried that newspaper jobs weren't going to take care of him. So in his mid-50s, he changed careers.
You know, you're starting to think of pensions and stuff like that. So I started applying for every union job I could. And I got on in this refinery and just kind of let it go.
So it was about trying to find a job where you'd have retirement security.
Some sort of
security.
Retirement, yeah, yeah.
Did it feel like a class transition for you identity-wise when you went from being a photojournalist to working a union job in an oil refinery?
Well, photojournalism had a cachet to it. It was fun, sometimes terrifying. But, I don't know. Guys in the oil patch are pretty basic. They know what they're doing, but they're definitely not educated folks, you know.
And so when your long-term disability runs out, you'll have a pension.
Yes.
And so do you feel pretty financially stable into your retirement?
Yeah, and partially because I don't aspire to moving up. Never did. So I have a 26-foot, when it's a bus conversion, my dad and I did together. And I always figure I could move into it and just, be one of the guys that drift around in parking and Walmart parking lots. So, you know, I've never felt the need for a big house or anything like that. I remember telling people when I was, when we'd BS in the Air Force, what I want to do is when I get, you know, to get back in the real world, is I want to have a small place with plenty of room to park my toys. So that's
what you got.
Yeah, that's what I got. And, of course, a pretty wife. And I got that, too, even though she doesn't live with me.
Ernie's been married for 43 years. His wife, Cindy, lives nearby.
My wife and I get along a lot better if we don't live together.
They've got three daughters, now in their 20s and 30s. One recently moved in with Ernie in his trailer. She walked in and out making breakfast while we talked. His other two kids also live in the area.
One of my daughters is much more upwardly mobile-oriented. And her husband works in a refinery, and they have a much larger house than anything I've ever lived in. I always kid about getting lost in it. And she won't let me bring my bus up there. If I want to take the grandkids for a ride, we'll meet somewhere.
Have you ever felt, do you remember ever feeling embarrassed about where you were fitting class-wise?
No. I was aware. I was aware how other people might feel. But everywhere you go, there's A, people that think they're better than you, and there's bullies, and always had to deal with them. But I never felt inferior to them.
I'm interested in what draws you to motorcycles and if it's related at all to this idea of not being invested in the rat race. Like, do you connect those at all? That you,
in a way, I don't care for the weekend biker kind of guys. You know, the guys who get the shiny $30,000 Harley and that. I think they're idiots. I gravitate to guys who like to go fast and have fun. It's a pure joy that almost anybody can afford. And I love, going to, two of my brothers live in Napa. I'll be cutting through traffic, and there'll be a stretch limo there. I always give them the finger. as I go by, slicing through traffic.
You do?
Yes.
Why?
Because I think they think they're better than they are.
Yeah.
That's the whole point to a limo. They'd be much more comfortable in a small SUV, but a limo is the status thing. So, yeah. Give them the one finger salute, you know?
That's Ernie Major at his home in Vallejo, California. I gave him a Death, Sex, and Money mug before I headed out. You can see a picture of him holding it in his recliner at deathsexmoney.org. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. I'm based at the Center for Investigative Reporting in Emeryville, California. Our team includes Katie Bishop, Annabelle Bacon, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Thanks to Stephanie Joyce, Dan DeZula, and Natalie Jones for their help on this episode. Our interns are Catherine Hsu and Anjali Mercado. This series, Opportunity Cost, is produced in collaboration with BuzzFeed News. You can find reported pieces, essays, and our five conversations with listeners about class and money at our website, deathsexmoney.org/class. The Reverend John Delore and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Find us on all three at Death, Sex, Money. Ernie's been living in this trailer for about 5 years now. And along the way, he's learned a couple of tricks for keeping his costs down.
I just have a couple electric heaters, but they're expensive to run. So, you know, cook a pie, cook some bread, cook some sweet taters, anything you want, and you heat the place up much cheaper.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.